Welcome to More or Less, the programme that would count a gift horse's teeth. This week we're devoting most of the next half hour to a measurement that's grown to dominate our thinking on what good education is all about and where we can get it. More than that, it's become the kind of measurement we now use to run half the country. We're going to tell the story of school league tables, performance tables as the government calls them, from the beginning into the future. We'll look at an idea that seemed strikingly simple, to tell parents how good schools are, but nearly 15 years on is about to be overhauled yet again. It's an object lesson in modern politics. Here then are the ups and downs of league tables.
It's a damn sight easier to lay it out as an objective than it is to achieve it. It is a weapon to inform parents in a much more sensible and informed way of information they had not hitherto had.
I think there's an argument that says we haven't actually quite yet worked out what this question is we want to answer.
This is a story of how politics collides with statistics, how simple ideals confront the raw messiness of life, and about our expectations of what measurement's really capable of. The vision in the beginning was of simplicity and parent power, with rankings and their raw material, performance assessments, becoming the dominant language of politics. But our story begins with a speech by the then Labour Prime Minister, James Callaghan, at Ruskin College 30 years ago.
The balance was wrong in the past. We have a responsibility now in this generation to see that we don't get it wrong in the other direction. There's no virtue in producing socially well-adjusted members of society who are unemployed because they don't have the skills, nor at the other extreme must they be technically efficient robots.
Jim Callaghan's speech was a landmark, a Prime Minister trespassing on the secret garden of the curriculum, demanding transparency and leading directly, some say, to the Conservative government's reforms in the 1980s, the national curriculum in 1988 with its key stages, a new inspection regime in 1992 managed by Ofsted, and later in the same year, the first league tables. Kenneth, now Lord Baker, was Education Secretary in the early part of that period. When standardised testing was introduced, he says, league tables became inevitable.
The purpose of tests was not to allocate children into success or failure. It was to measure their achievement. And if they were not achieving the standards of the national curriculum in 7, 11, 14, remedial action had to be taken. That was the purpose of the whole tests. But they became documents. Children were told about them. If children were told about them, their parents were told about them. And parents got very interested in this. So it was natural to publish the results of the tests.
But teachers and unions were hostile. The scene was set for confrontation.
The largest teaching union, the NUT, is asking school governors to break the law and withhold the results of this spring's national tests.
Parental expectation and political promise were powerful forces, but it wasn't long before the ideal faced a blizzard of statistical objections. Kevin McConway, a statistician with the Open University.
Well, I think the difficulty is that simply producing a league table of schools on the basis of how the pupils in those schools do, let's say in GCSEs, is really blaming the schools for bad performance on aspects that have nothing to do with what the school could have been expected to achieve. That's the difficulty. And rewarding schools, say, simply because they happen to have particularly able pupils.
So we're standing here in the middle of Bristol. Sun's shining, the wind is blowing. We can see St. Mary Redcliffe Parish Church, famously described by Elizabeth I as being the most beautiful parish church in England. It's in rather a strange bit of Bristol, now largely dominated by docks, and we actually come to the St. Mary Redcliffe School, looks like it went up in the 1960s, reminds me strongly of my school, all very square and metal windows, and a very pale and not terribly attractive colour blue paint, lots of tower blocks around, not an area of great economic privilege. It'd be interesting to see what the school feels like and whether the school has a strong sense of where it stands in the league tables and what they've meant to it.
I think as teachers we were quite angry about the introduction of league tables.
Elizabeth Gilpin is head teacher at St. Mary Redcliffe.
We felt what was important was the development of the whole child and that actually that's really hard to encapsulate in a league table. As a parent, it does give you kind of pointers and does raise interesting questions. So I suppose I had mixed feelings really when they first came in.
And the school you were in at the time, was it a school that came high up the raw league tables or low down? Was that an issue for the school?
The last school I was head of was a very good school in Oxford, and we had 26% of children who had free school meals, and we had a third of children who had special needs. So although we provided a very good education and we had children getting into Oxford and Cambridge and we had children making really, really good progress, on the raw league tables we tended to obviously score lower down because we were dealing with students who had particular learning problems and difficulties. And so I used to get quite angry about schools that had much more privileged intakes where perhaps they were making less progress with individual students, but it was easier for them to come higher up the league tables.
So, an unjust condemnation of good schools? Kenneth Clark, MP, was Secretary of State for Education under both Margaret Thatcher and John Major.
It was the newspapers who, very predictably, just described each other as league tables, which we never did. We called them performance tables, which is what they are. And everybody got very excited about the practice of the newspapers of producing league tables and saying what the top 10 schools in the country were and all the rest of it. I'm not really impressed by all the fuss about that because I think it assumes that the public is stupid. The big argument was all about whether you could achieve more if you had a good catchment area compared with a school that had a poor catchment area. Well, of course you can. You certainly should. I didn't accept the argument of opponents that this was the only explanation for differences of attainment. I strongly suspected that the performance tables would show that some people who did have a lot of social deprivation amongst their pupils could still achieve quite good results.
Ken Clark. But whatever we called them, however we arranged the data, it still wasn't clear whether the published figures were telling us what we thought. With more research, more oddities became apparent. Professor Harvey Goldstein of Bristol University.
You cannot be very precise about where a school is in a league table or a ranking because you only have a relatively small number of pupils in any one year that you're using to judge a school. There is a large measure of uncertainty, what we call an uncertainty interval, surrounding any numerical estimate that you might give. And it turns out that those intervals are extraordinarily large, so large, in fact, that for about two-thirds to three-quarters of all secondary schools, if you're judging by GCSE or A-level results, cannot be separated from the overall national average. In other words, there's nothing you can say about whether they're really above or below the average of all pupils.
With some schools being so small as to have only a handful of pupils in a year group, it might only take one to do badly, and results could fall by 10% in one year, with dramatic impact on a school's apparent performance. The measurements were proving much more complicated than expected. What's more, schools were finding ingenious ways of playing the system. Peter Timms, Professor of Education at Durham University.
You might, if you're in a secondary school, choose easier subjects. By those, I mean those that are less harshly graded. You might move the students away from sciences, maths and modern foreign languages. You might try to avoid getting pupils into your school who look as though they're not going to get very good grades. You would concentrate on borderline pupils and let go hang those who are gifted or those with special needs. So there'd be a number of ways in which you might play this game in order to move up.
One school saw its GCSE league table results plummet from 87% to 27% of children achieving 5 or more A to C passes once English and maths were included. It moved from first in its borough to 10th out of 15. The pattern was repeated across the country, with 10% of state schools showing drops of over 20%. In this atmosphere of accusation and upheaval over the raw league tables, but still strong public support, the change to require maths and English was a fundamental revision. Two more had also been taking shape. Ken Clark and first, Harvey Goldstein.
The researchers for some time had been criticising the raw league tables and emphasising the need to make adjustments to produce value-added league tables. The first recognition by government was, in fact, when Gillian Shepherd, Conservative Secretary of State, officially accepted, I think it was in 1995, that the government should move towards producing value-added tables.
My own local authority, who are amongst the many people busily campaigning against the whole thing, used to say that the data wasn't good enough, they needed value added, to which I was persuaded by that. But I said, well, when we were in a position to do it, I'd be quite happy to go on to producing value added measurements in the performance tables that we produced.
I took over the education brief in October 94, just after Tony was elected leader.
David Blunkett.
We'd had, as a party, vehement disagreement with the then government about league tables, and really had taken the line that the professional teachers' unions had been taking against them. I took the decision with Tony Blair that, firstly, we needed to demonstrate that we were on the side of parents, on the side of giving information, on the side of transparency. And so one of the first things I did, actually on David Frost's Sunday programme in November of that year, was to go on and say, I'm reversing the policy, we're in favour of league tables, but we want to improve and change them so we get added value. I had no idea at that time it was going to take as long as it has to actually get to where I wanted to be.
On coming to power, Labour's policy was to support value-added performance tables. This meant testing a pupil's attainment early on, testing again later, and comparing progress. But it was crudely done, and by benchmarking performance against very rough averages in the early years, it enabled selective schools in particular, which creamed off pupils above average, to appear to be adding a great deal of value. Headlines announced that selective schools added most. In fact, the value was there from the start, and the first value-added tables, studied as they were not worthy of the name.
The crude added value measures were actually, again, not satisfactory, because we needed time, firstly, to get them right, to sophisticate them, and to allow a whole cohort to actually move through the system. And that, of course, takes 7 years at primary and 5 years at secondary, just to get through to 16.
Hence, the next major revision. Farewell value-added, and from next year, welcome to contextualised value-added, or CVA, as it's known. Kevin McConway.
Well, this is to do with an attempt to measure what the school adds, what it does for its pupils that perhaps another school wouldn't do if it had the same bunch of pupils. So what it seeks to do is to take out of consideration things which are essentially outside the school's control. I mean, it's always a bit arguable what's totally outside the school's control.
And so allowance is made for all kinds of children who are not expected to do as well. Boys, for example. Those on free school meals, who've been in care or with special educational needs. Allowance is made for first language, ethnicity, measures of deprivation or poverty, measures of pupil mobility, exact age, and the spread of abilities within the school.
They put all those into a statistical model, and for each pupil, they produce a predicted value for how that pupil will do at GCSE level in terms of a particular way of scoring GCSE grades. Then for the school, they look at the difference between what the pupil actually gets in their exams at age 16 and what this statistical model predicted they would get. The idea is to say, compared to people who are similar to the pupils you have in your school, is your school getting good results?
The effect has been to turn the ranking of some schools upside down. For example, on a sample of 370 schools, Kesteven and Grantham Girls' School was 30th on the GCSE list. On the CVA tables, it came 317th. The biggest winner in this comparison was St Albans C of E School in Birmingham. On the GCSE table, it was 344th out of 370, but on the CVA, they were 16th. But there are worries about these tables too. Are we simply letting schools off the obligation to find successful ways of teaching certain pupils who now seem labelled underachievers? And there's more. Harvey Goldstein.
You still have the issue of the uncertainty surrounding those, and that's still large, so it still turns out that you cannot reliably separate most schools from the average or indeed from each other. So that problem remains. The second issue, which to date governments have not addressed and show little sign of addressing, I have to say, is that there isn't a single so-called value-added measure. We know again from lots of research that some schools seem to do relatively well in terms of initially high-performing children, but not for low-performing children. And for other schools, it might be the other way around. Some schools seem to do rather well for girls, but not for boys, and other schools the other way around. In other words, schools are differentially effective. And what happens at the moment in the so-called value-added league tables is that all that is average. That's not taking account of. And of course, that, in a way, is also unfair to many schools.
Very few parents have children who are 50% boy and 50% girl and have an average kind of level of ability across the whole. So we want to know about how the school will do for our child, not for how it does for some hypothetical average.
Exactly.
The contextual nature of value added is a tremendous goal to achieve. It's a damn sight easier to lay it out as an objective than it is to achieve it. And the reason for that is that people will argue about the particular context they're in, the nature of what's happening to the school, not just what was happening to it, the changes that social and economic change bring about in terms of the intake, and of course what is demanded by government itself. And all of those factors can be taken into account, but they end up with another set of winners and losers. And as my own experience shows me, the winners are very rarely vocal and the losers are always vocal.
David Plunkett. For some critics, the last 15 years have shown us how insanely elusive was the goal of a simple set of figures to tell parents how good schools are. Peter Timms, for one, thinks the complexity so great as to have made it all pointless. I put it to him, are things really that hopeless?
There are many areas of individual and institutional life where we do provide summary information that can be useful. And it would seem odd simply to say, well, this is just too complicated, too hard, it would take too many numbers. To say that it's simply too complicated, doesn't it smack of priests in the Middle Ages saying that we shouldn't have the Bible translated into the vernacular, since then people would read it and it was too complicated for them to understand?
Okay, I have sympathy with that, and I can see that we do need information, and as a parent I did want information. But as a researcher, I see that actually that information is extremely flawed. I don't believe now that you can get a single figure that would represent the whole of a secondary school or even a primary school, which is a simpler context in which you're working. And the bottom line here is, what is the consequence of publishing? What is the impact on the education of children? It certainly hasn't improved it. In some cases, it's pretty clear that it's done damage. So if we've got something that we're arguing is needed because people should have it, well, let's look at what actually the impact is. And if the answer is that it's negative, we need to bite this bullet and say this is not doing good. We need to back off from this.
Sarah Tether speaks for the Liberal Democrats on education and also feels that the whole exercise may have been worthless.
Yes, I certainly feel so. And I think the government are beginning to recognise that now as well. Alan Johnson, in his more recent announcement, has been trying to row away from the idea of league tables as they've been published. So I'm very hopeful that the government are finally recognising, perhaps really very late, but recognising that it has been a rather damaging exercise.
Do you think we should look on this as a failed experiment and shut the whole thing down?
That would be my view.
Do you think, whatever you would like, there's ever a possibility that we could get away from the publication of this kind of data?
Oh, yes. It's been done elsewhere. Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland, the rest of the United Kingdom, other than England, has moved away from these things. The Irish Republic has, parts of Australia, notably New South Wales.
And if we don't have this data, or better forms of it, publicly available, how are parents to decide where their children should go to school?
I think that's a very interesting question that I'm not totally qualified to answer, but if you look at the way in which parents make decisions about schools, they will visit schools, they will talk to people.
Because as a statistician, however bad we think the misinterpretation of the large data sets, we also have to believe that the anecdotal conversation with Arthur down the road must be even worse.
Yes, I think that's right. And that we could have a long debate about how parents should choose schools, and I think at the end of the day we would probably have to agree that there are severe limitations on the ability to choose successfully.
I'm really in two minds.
Head teacher Elizabeth Gilpin.
I think league tables have had some benefits in our country, because I think that the existence of league tables has encouraged teachers to actually grapple with data and to challenge their own practices. However, I think league tables in some areas have deeply damaged certain schools that were fragile because of high intakes of special needs students and students from socially deprived backgrounds. So the question is really, does the benefit around discussion around data outweigh the damage to particular schools that league tables does? And I think that's a really difficult question to answer.
We've come up with various forms of league tables that answer various questions, and in hindsight they're never quite the right question. People can always come up with reasons, plausible reasons, why a particular school is down the bottom of the table or up the top of the table. That has not much to do with the school, but how we sort that out is really quite difficult and complicated.
And do you think it's a specific case of a more general problem in measurement and statistics, that although there's something terribly neat and clean-cut about numbers, there's often something terribly messy and complicated and difficult about working out what it is we should try to measure in whatever field we're trying to assess performance?
I think you're quite right on that. I think the problem is, if we decide that the statistics will give us the answer, and that will be the only aspect that we need to take into account, my view on this is that statistics can throw important light on a huge range of questions, otherwise I wouldn't waste my time being a statistician. But that doesn't mean that they in themselves provide an answer to those questions, because most questions that are interesting are very complicated, and they have aspects that are difficult to measure, aspects when we're not sure what we mean by measuring them, and arguably aspects that you simply can't measure.
Kevin McConway. Has it all been a waste of time that told us nothing? Ian Shargan from the National Foundation of Educational Research is a supporter of the latest reforms, but suggests we need to change the way we talk about data.
I don't think we ever, meaning the academic community, ever, as I say, thought it was going to be easy. What I think is that people are always looking for simple solutions to complicated problems. The actual difference that a school makes is quite difficult to unpick, because there's a lot of what we statisticians might call noise, other factors which influence the performance of pupils. And although schools do make a difference, that difference is fairly small compared with some of the other factors which are influencing pupils' performance. So we knew that it was going to require some fairly sophisticated analysis in order to do that. The challenge is making the analysis sophisticated enough and yet being able to explain the results in terms that people can understand. I think that's the main challenge now, is to make the results accessible, useful, and allow people to use them properly with a proper degree of understanding and possibly even skepticism, so that they can understand what it's telling them about schools without over-interpreting the results.
A pipe dream still? I don't think so. Performance measurement has woken up some head teachers. It has also led to all sorts of misinterpretation and game playing, but it has been a tool for beginning to understand, finally, the value of knowing more about how pupils are performing in order to work with them individually to help them get on. Ian Shargan and first head teacher Elizabeth Gilpin.
Yeah, I'm not against the intelligent use of data. Data is very important to us as a leadership team, because data is what we use to really analyse how are we doing, how are our students doing. We use data in conversation with students so that students are aware of the range of grades that people with their previous grades might tend to get in the future. Data is also useful to us at a whole school level, where we look at particular groups of students who might be underperforming. And so again, but that raises for us questions of why that might be the case. Data is also useful for us where we look at within school variation between subject areas. So I do passionately feel data used well is a good thing.
We've collected a great deal of data about children in this country. We've probably got more data on the pupils in England than any other country in the world. Having collected that data, I think there's an onus on us to use it properly, to do a good job of giving information back to schools which will help them to improve. If we just sat on the data and didn't do anything like this with it, then we'd be guilty.
Ian Shargan. We cannot be against data. The question's entirely about how we make sense of the data we've got. This has been a 15-year education for all of us about what we can know and how to label it with modesty. The latest attempt, contextualized value-added tables, is ripe for yet more overinterpretation and debatable measurement. In some ways, they go beyond data in a hopeless quest for perfection. But the question is too difficult. To answer it properly, we'd need to know all about every child and every teacher. Better to recognize that the data can tell us only so much than continue the desperate search for a crock of gold at the end of a rainbow. One last word, this one from the students. Aidan Marshall, Emily Thompson and Chloe Janssen-Lester are sixth formers at St Mary Redcliffe, who seem to understand better, perhaps, than we do.
Often you look in just to kind of have a pop at your friends who go to other schools and say, oh, ours did better than yours this year and this kind of thing, but it's quite superficial, I think.
Yeah, often it's quite left on the kitchen table for our parents are looking at it and we might glance at it, but it's generally for our parents, I think. Like, to the general public, I think they are quite important because if you have, you know, your children at a certain school and you want to gauge kind of what's going to happen to them and how their education is going to go, then it is important, but I think on quite a superficial level. It's very hard to get a good overall average look at each department and weigh them up against each other and get a fair judgment of where your school is at, because each school, I think, has benefits in some areas, obviously, and that's why you send people send their children to certain schools.
And sometimes you get teachers that they're trying to sort of teach you to pass your exam, not teach you the subject.
The moment that someone starts to think, oh, we'll include this number of special needs people this year because it will improve our school, as in terms of statistics, they're starting to lose their grip on what it is to be a teacher, I think.
I think that's the general problem with statistics as a whole, is the idea that people become so focused on getting these statistics right and being at a certain place in the league table that the statistics stop being an indicator of where someone is and actually become the instigator of what's going on in the school. And I think that's the problem, and that's the manipulation you get with them.
The students of St Mary Redcliffe School in Bristol. That's all from More or Less. We're back again at the same time next week.
More or Less is presented by Andrew Dilnot, who's principal of St Hugh's College, Oxford. It's produced by Michael Blastland in association with the Open University.